Welcome to the Engines of Techsanity. Episode 11, When Techsanity Fails, and When It Doesn't. About once a year, it gets cold enough in San Antonio for people to overreact and pretend like it's going to snow. But since January of 1986, that hadn't actually happened. So when I looked at the following week's forecast on Friday, February 12th, 2021, I didn't really believe what I saw. The forecasted high for Monday, February 15th was 30 degrees, with projections of freezing rain, sleet, and maybe snow, and a low of 14 degrees. Those kind of numbers didn't even make sense, and so, like a lot of Texans, I basically ignored them. The Electric Reliability Council of Texas, or ERCOT, however, was definitely thinking about it, and they were just as definitely worried. ERCOT, as most people in Texas now know, is the independent system operator of Texas's electrical grid. But what makes ERCOT especially unique is that every other state in the U.S. gets their electricity from interstate grids that cross state lines and are regulated by the federal government. Texas's size, energy richness, and independent nature, some might call it hostility to federal regulation, has allowed it to develop its own self-regulated electrical grid. Inspired by the success of deregulation in the airline and other industries, in 1999, Texas also deregulated its electrical markets, which means that instead of fixing prices for electricity so as to guarantee a fixed profit, a la the Anglo-American model, electricity generators in Texas and distributors would now have to compete on price, a la the Southwest Airlines model. And like with the old Spanish irrigation ditches, the transmission lines that move the electricity around, they were maintained as open access, bienes de uso común, to be administered in this case by ERCOT, just like the old water masters opening and closing the floodgates of the canals of an irrigation system. What ERCOT does not do is produce the electricity that they transport. To get the electricity onto the transmission wires, ERCOT runs auctions every 15 minutes where electricity producers compete to offer their electrons to the grid. In these auctions, the lowest price wins, in the same way that airlines compete for customers now on routes by trying to offer the most competitive ticket prices. Let me back up a second. Electricity production and consumption is typically measured in megawatts. Going into the winter of 2021, ERCOT theoretically had 119,000 megawatts of installed electrical generation connected to its system available to bid their electricity into these auctions that I just mentioned. About 25% of that 119,000 megawatts, however, comes from so-called intermittent sources like wind or solar. The wind doesn't always blow and the sun doesn't always shine. And plus, there's always some gas and coal plants down for maintenance too, which is all just to say that the 119,000 megawatt number is never all there. The actual reliably callable capacity on any given day during the winter of 2021 was closer to 82,500 megawatts. Which is still more than double the average statewide demand, which typically sits in the 40,000 megawatt range. In fact, the most demand that ERCOT had ever registered on a winter day was about 69,000 megawatts. Until Sunday, February 14th, 2021, that is. As morning broke on Sunday, February 14th, and the freezing temperatures outside didn't, ERCOT could tell that problems were forming. Natural gas prices had started to shoot up, a sure sign that natural gas-powered power plants were struggling to find the gas they needed to produce electricity. Then, wind farms started falling offline as the winds died down and equipment started to freeze off, and the sun stopped shining too, cutting off the solar farms. At 8:30 a.m. on that Sunday the 14th, ERCOT issued a voluntary appeal for conservation. Texans, however, cranked up their thermostats as temperatures across the state remained stubbornly below freezing. At 2 p.m. that day, still on Sunday the 14th, ERCOT announced anticipated emergency operations, and at 7 p.m., a new winter peak demand of 69,222 megawatts was reached, fully 20% higher than ERCOT had expected to experience in their worst-case scenario that winter. ERCOT, at this point, scrambled to call online every power plant that they could. there should have been available another 13,000 megawatts at least, according to the 82,500 megawatt number that we talked about earlier. But when ERCOT ran the auctions and called the plants, the electricity didn't show up. At 12:15 a.m., now early in the morning of Monday, February 15th, ERCOT declared a level 1 emergency alert. Less than an hour later, at 1:07 a.m., they escalated that to a level 2 alert. 13 minutes later, at 1:20 a.m., they ramped up to a level 3 alert. And what the different emergency alert levels mean is less important than appreciating how quickly the situation was spiraling out of control. If electricity demand exceeded electricity supply long enough, it could drop the frequency of the entire ERCOT grid, a truly catastrophic situation that, best case, would have damaged every single piece of equipment connected to the grid, and worst case, could have led to a total blackout that would have taken months to restart. And so in order to save the grid, ERCOT started so-called rotating outages, better known to Texans as rolling blackouts, which meant that ERCOT basically started turning off the electricity to entire parts of the state during the coldest freeze on record. And not just small outages or small parts of the state. ERCOT started by turning off 10,800 megawatts, 1/6 of the entire state's demand at the time. But it wasn't enough. A few minutes later, at 1:26 a.m., 1,400 megawatts of production just disappeared, stopped producing without warning, followed by another 2,400 megawatts over the next 16 minutes. The grid frequency started dropping again. And so at 1:55 a.m., ERCOT actively turned off another 3,500 megawatts. At 1:57 a.m., another 1,600 megawatts. And at 1:58 a.m., 2,000 more megawatts. Basically, an additional 10,000 megawatts in total had disappeared in less than an hour since ERCOT had cut the initial 10,000 megawatts. In plain English, this 20,000 megawatt drop represented something like a third of the people in the state who are now without electricity. And still, power plants kept cutting out without warning. Gas plants couldn't find gas. The wind stopped blowing. The goddamn nuclear plant, for Christ's sakes, lost a feed water pump and was only producing at about 1/3 of its capacity, further complicating ERCOT's efforts to spread the pain of the blackouts by truly rotating them to different geographies. Instead, ERCOT had to leave the lights and the electric furnaces that most Texans relied on for heat off entirely for huge swaths of the state, out of fear that if they turned anything back on, it might crash the few parts of the grid that were still working. In fact, ERCOT actually still had to shed a few thousand more megawatts at 7 p.m. that evening of the 15th, 17 hours after they had initially started making these cuts. By Tuesday, February 16th, Texas, the energy capital of the world, was only producing 47% of the electricity that it nominally should have been capable of producing. What made this situation particularly painful was that Texas had nowhere to turn for replacement capacity. Not necessarily because it had deregulated its markets, as many parts of the U.S. had in the 1990s, but because what had made Texas's deregulation so different was that the Texas grid remained disconnected from the rest of the United States. Not all of Texas, to be clear. The cities on the edges, El Paso, Amarillo, Texarkana, and Beaumont, to name a few, were still connected to the larger U.S. power pools. But the rest of Texas's 52,000 miles of intrastate transmission wires had remained disconnected from the rest of the United States in order to avoid federal oversight. Texas's independent spirit and frontier model of regulation had left it physically and jurisdictionally isolated, and left it literally out in the cold. As a part of my day job, I was on some of these daily statewide calls organized by the largest utilities, pipeline operators, and regulators that were trying to figure out what was going on. And I recall the moment on the morning of Wednesday the 17th, I think, when everyone realized what the biggest problem was. The rolling blackouts were keeping electricity from getting to the natural gas processing plants that were needed to get the gas to the power plants to be able to end the rolling blackouts. You can't make the wind blow and you can't make the sun shine, but you can make a gas turbine produce electricity if you can get gas to it. ERCOT typically relies on gas plants for 40 to 50% of its electricity, but during Winter Storm Uri, half of the natural gas production in the state was offline, and 85% of the processing plants that clean up the gas before it goes to a power plant were shut down. Once ERCOT was able to prioritize electricity to those assets, the curve turned. And on Wednesday, February 17th, electricity production finally started to ramp up. Though it would take until February the 19th and later in some cases for freezing temperatures to break and for services to be restored to most citizens of the state. I've explained ERCOT's role in Winter Storm Uri here sympathetically, but the fact is ERCOT still deserves plenty of blame for what happened to Texans during the storm. Prior to that winter, ERCOT had performed several worst-case scenario drills, but the problem was that they had modeled each worst-case scenario on its own, not in the aggregate. That is, they had modeled what would happen if the wind stopped blowing, or if the gas plants fell offline, or if demand spiked from everybody in the state turning on their furnaces all at once. But they hadn't modeled all three of those things happening at the same time. And so they had projected the winter peak demand to be something like 58,000 megawatts. Their worst case scenario was 67,000 megawatts. It turns out that during Winter Storm Uri, Texans actually would have needed something like 77,000 megawatts. And yet for almost 3 days, at the peak of Uri's freezing temperatures, ERCOT was moving around less than 50,000 megawatts, two-thirds of what the citizens of the state needed. So here's the question we all ought to be asking ourselves. Did Texanity kill 246 Texans in Winter Storm Uri? Or maybe as many as 700, according to unofficial estimates. Either number would make it the second worst natural disaster in Texas history, behind only the Galveston hurricane of 1900. Did Texas mythology and Texans' sense of their own exceptionalism lead them to create a system that killed Texans? Well, Texas's political and media class has enjoyed debating this question as a way to distract from the rather nuanced and technical discussion of what would have actually prevented this tragedy. Democrats attacked the system because some people made a lot of money during the storm, but it proposed no solutions that would actually lead to the construction of more reliable baseload generation, or that seemed to appreciate the realities of what things cost. Republicans, on the other hand, have defended the current system under the mistaken belief that it's a functioning free market, even while ignoring the fact that electricity deregulation has failed in its most basic free market promise, to lower electricity rates for consumers. Even before Winter Storm Uri, in most circumstances, an average ratepayer in Texas was better off in a regulated market, like Austin's or San Antonio's, than they were in the deregulated parts of the rest of the state. And after the economic damage of Uri is reckoned, I think you'll see that Texans have given up any marginal financial gain that they might have realized from deregulation in the two decades prior. It's a painful thing when the lessons of history don't seem to apply to the present. But there are a few lessons from Texas's past that still do apply here, I'd argue. At its best, Texas stands as a shining example of pragmatism as being the great, eternally relevant virtue of a frontier society. It's the quality that I want to believe carried Texans through centuries of violence and disease and change. Far removed from the centers of dogmatic cultural conformity, a frontier society has both the luxury and the obligation take what works and discard what doesn't. Like when the first Lipan horsemen abandoned their nomadic culture in favor of a mounted existence. Or when the administrators of remote flood irrigation systems took on the dual role of regulator and promoter. Or when Gail Borden wrote off his meat biscuit and his life savings to turn toward condensed milk. Or when Texas legislators broke from the southern model of railroad regulation, or when the Hamel brothers innovated their way through the heaving sands of Spindletop, or when Jack Kilby settled for semiconductors, or when Southwest Airlines debunked the economic orthodoxy of so-called natural monopolies. Let me offer another example to you that I haven't been able to shoehorn in anywhere else yet, but that directly serves as a precedent for Texan pragmatism. Texas was the first jurisdiction in the Anglo-American world to dissolve the distinction between courts of law and courts of equity. Let me explain what that means. Before the 1830s, Anglo-American law was rigidly formalistic. Even the most deeply wronged party could have their lawsuit thrown out for small technicalities in how they wrote up their complaint. It was a system that favored the well-connected and the well-lawyered. Those plaintiffs whose cases failed in these courts of law had the option to bring them then in parallel courts of equity, which in theory were based on principles of fairness more so than on technicalities, But the very existence of two parallel legal systems demonstrates how unfair many of the outcomes of each system operating individually could sometimes be. In contrast, Texas lawyers that had lived in Mexican Texas had been exposed to the flexibleness of the Spanish system of demanda-respuesta, or petition and answer. The Spanish system, in which the judge is charged with getting to the bottom of the case rather than just refereeing the two parties, encouraged courts not to throw out a poorly argued case that otherwise seems sound on its merits. And so in 1836, the new Texas Constitution eliminated the distinction between courts of law and courts of equity in favor of a unified, call it Spanish-style court system. Now, there's plenty of other aspects of the Spanish system that are more absurdly formalistic than the English one, don't get me wrong. But precisely because they sat on the frontiers of these two cultural spheres, the Texas framers in 1836 had the luxury of cherry-picking the best from each system. Even in 1840, when Texas formally adopted the English common law, the unification of the courts of law and equity was preserved. Quote, "Should the cause more properly belong to equity jurisdiction, the court shall, without delay, proceed to try the same according to the principles of equity," end quote. Or as Chief Justice Hemphill said in 1849, "Texas courts recognize no distinction between law and equity because the Texas legal system descends from the Spanish civil law tradition as well." But I find it funny that in law school, even at the University of Texas Law School where I went, they will teach you that New York was the first jurisdiction to dissolve the distinction between law and equity, even though that only happened by operation of statute 10 years after Texas had done so. But the reason they'll say New York is first is because Texas was never really an Anglo-American common law jurisdiction, which to me seems to be conceding the point in an attempt to disprove it. New York, however, is an established center of Anglo-American culture and boasts a large megaphone. And innovation on the fringes is always perceived as a threat to the established centers of culture in places like New York or Mexico City, both of which I love, but both of which go to great lengths to tear down anything they see as threatening their cultural primacy. Hence, the rather unattractive spectacle of the great arbiters of culture dancing through the ruins of Winter Storm Uri, or proclaiming the end of airline deregulation every time Southwest Airlines cancels a flight, or why it's hard to find anyone's name but Willis Carrier from New York in a history of air conditioning. Or, viewed from the South, it's somebody from Mexico City referring disparagingly to pochos, Mexican Americans, as somehow culturally impure and hence inferior. Or it's like the image that I used as the cover art for episode 3, showing a caricature of a Texan, as imagined in a New York newspaper in 1845, that depicts this archetypal Texan as some kind of animalistic mix of Southern slave catcher and Mexican bandito, conflating the sin of being a slaveholder with the sin of being Mexican, I guess. But sometimes, the frontier slips one past the center. On June 19th, 1865, a Union general arrived in Galveston, Texas, with the news that by operation of the Emancipation Proclamation 2 years prior, all of the enslaved people of Texas were now free. The next year, Texas freedmen gathered to commemorate this anniversary, and in every year thereafter, and soon it spread from Galveston in 1866 to Austin in 1867 to a much broader swath of the state by 1872. By the 1930s, Juneteenth celebrations in Texas frequently drew tens, if not hundreds of thousands of celebrants, in the face of Jim Crow laws and the resurgence of the KKK and the height of Civil War lost cause nostalgia. And yet so powerful was the memory, and so persistent were the celebrants of Juneteenth, that even in the face of this hostility, in 1938, the governor of Texas was forced to recognize Juneteenth as the official day of observance of emancipation in Texas. By 1945, the holiday had spread to the West Coast, and by the time of the U.S. Civil Rights Movement, it had spread across the United States. In 1979, the still very conservative Texas state legislature made Juneteenth an official Texas holiday. Fittingly, it's also recognized today in Texas's sister state, Coahuila, where a community of black Seminoles has kept the memory of emancipation alive. And of course, in 2021, it became a United States national holiday. At first glance, there's a certain irony to the fact that history-obsessed Texas's greatest contribution to the United States rituals of historic remembrance is a national holiday celebrated in memory of perhaps the most oppressed class of people in the history of Texas. Of course, it's only ironic if we make the old mistake of assuming that the history of Texas is only the history of powerful Texans, instead of the history of all Texans. By its nature, a season dedicated to the history of technological engines in Texas history was always going to be more focused on powerful Texans than on disempowered ones. But there's nothing more powerfully Texan, I'd argue, than Juneteenth, the commemoration by an oppressed people of the historical memory of their emancipation in the shadow of a society that was so actively hostile to them for so long. These are the stories of human resilience that keep me exploring the past in order to help anchor myself in the present. And although economic engines and technological innovations probably explain a lot more about history than we want them to, they don't explain everything. Thank you for listening to this season of A New History of Old Texas. This season is brought to you by the 11th Street River House in Bandera, Texas. Sort of. My wife and I have dreamed for years about owning a place in Bandera, and we finally bought a house there last year. 4 blocks from the bars, 3 blocks from the Frontier Times Museum, with 120 feet of Medina River frontage and a collection of historic Texas maps on the wall, curated by yours truly, it's a great place to spend a weekend and to sort of indirectly support this podcast. Look it up under 11th Street River House on Airbnb or on VRBO. Editing for this episode was performed by Susana Canseco, sound engineering by Stephen Bennett. Stephen Bennett also composed and performed the theme music. You can find more about Stephen at info@nosomedia.com. David Moore designed the cover art for this season. You can find him at illustrationonline.com. For more information on our sources and other projects, please check out www.brandonseal.com.